May the words of my mouth and the meditations of our hearts be always acceptable in your sight, O God, our strength and our Redeemer. Amen. Please be seated. Well, for those of you who are hardcore Episcopalians, and I know there are some, you are wondering, doubtless, what we're doing reading Epiphany lessons while we're still in the season of Christmas. This gospel lesson, I'm a little confused. I had to even look. I say, have I just made a mistake? Because the wise men shouldn't be getting to the cradle quite yet. But here we are, so we're almost through the Christmas season. We have just a couple of things to talk about. I want to talk about all these metaphors, and I know it is like one of the great cliches of our time. You know, it's not the destination, it's the journey. But it really is. You know, so we're going to use a little bit of that. You know, these metaphors of journeying. And then I need to talk about King Herod. Because Herod, I've always been a little curious why Herod hasn't taken a place a little more as a figure that represents such a recurring tendency of the world and the way power is exercised. But first, about journeying. The first point is a small one, but it just has to do with the collect. O God, who didst wonderfully create and yet more wonderfully restore the dignity of human nature. And that is one of the sort of the guiding metaphors of the whole Christian story as we have really received it, which is we were better in the past. We have lost something that we once had. You know, and I mean that the stories around the fall in the garden, that we have somehow lost our way, that we have been diminished. And I'm not sure that's a very helpful way of looking at ourselves. It doesn't tally very well at all with what we know from a scientific perspective of sort of the emergence of and the dynamism of creation itself. So that I think we should maybe really quite consciously stop thinking that there is anything in our past that we need to return to. I mean, I think the story is really how we as human beings came to be both blessed and burdened with our particular kind of consciousness and awareness that does seem to separate us from the other creatures with whom we share this little planet. And we do seem to have a measure of freedom. It's not nearly as great as we usually think it is. But we do seem to have a measure of freedom. Shall I do this or that? And of course, that may make it seem as if we have some innocence that we have lost in the past, because we often make egregious mistakes with our choices. Nonetheless, I think the better metaphor is that we are being called forward, and that our future lies ahead of us, and that God is not trying to restore us, as rather bring us to fulfillment. Our future is in the future, not in the past. We didn't lose something, we changed. We have changed, and we are a type of creature that we still don't understand, but here we are on this little planet. And our dignity is not looking backward, it is looking forward. So, restoration. We're back at Psalm 84 again, which, for my money, we could read Psalm 84 every week. And that would be fine with me. It's one of my favorites. I love the imagery. And you've heard me speak about this passage in there. Those who go through the desolate valley will find the place of springs. And of course, blessed are those whose hearts are set on the pilgrim's way, that sense that we are all journeying. But what seems so absolutely crucial is to go through the desolate valley, you will find it a place of springs. To go through the place you want to avoid. To go through the place that frightens you, that confronts you with grief or loss or confusion or your own fallibility. Wherever the desolate valley is for you, and the inclination inclination is to want to avoid it. And that, of course, leaves us with a divided self. And so to head into the desolate valley, you find yourself there. You're no longer divided. You find that you will encounter what you had been trying to avoid, and it doesn't kill you. But you can only find that if you go into those places that you're afraid. And I want to put this in the larger context. One of the core spiritual insights of the entire tradition is trying to come to a perspective from which we behold the world and ourselves, and we don't have to leave anything out. And the desolate valley would be in that category. Oh, that's one of those places that we want to avoid. The broader question is loving one's enemies. Enemies here standing for everything that we wish were not in the world. Just make it go away. And that's a strategy that simply doesn't work. It redivides and redivides the world and perpetuates conflict. And so whether it's at a really quite an intimate level of head into the desolate valley and you will find your own renewal there, or love your enemies and transform the world, the basic principle is always trying to include those things that we are tempted to exclude, so that it's one world and one God who is the creator of all. I mean, that is like core insight. We keep coming back to it. And then there's that wonderful image from Ephesians, that the eyes of our hearts be enlightened. The heart is always the biblical issue. It's never, and it's funny, as you know, we are now so flooded with information. But information has never been the biblical issue. As Ezekiel, the promise that comes in the book of Ezekiel, I will take from my people their hearts of stone and give them hearts of flesh. I've been watching a little television recently, and I see, as many of the nonprofits are soliciting, there are lots of advertisements featuring very woebegone little puppies right now on television. And it's appropriate that you respond with compassion. But this is really, really low-hanging fruit to be moved by a little puppy. And it's not really a sign that your heart is a heart of flesh and not a heart of stone. The heart of flesh, I mean, extrapolate from the little puppy whose plight moves you, and then allow your heart to engage the world in more and more subtle ways. I mean, the whole issue of a hardened heart is that we walk by things that ought to move us to grief or outrage or compassion, that we just walk by. We're not moved. That unresponsiveness. The unresponsiveness is something I think that drove Jesus to great frustration. And yet, what is? I mean, what were the Magi seeking? What is this enlightened heart? And one of the ways I think about it is it's a perspective. It's a perspective that would allow, I imagine it for myself, a perspective that would allow me to walk through any circumstance I might conceivably encounter without running away from it. Whether it's my own aging, whether it's mistakes I make, whether it's my mortality, whether it's relationships, whether it's whatever it is, the perspective of an enlightened heart that would allow me to say, yes, I'll work with this. Yes, I'll work with this. And you can kind of watch that in Jesus. where at the last he even had to say that of his own dying, his terrible betrayal by his people, and saying, even this, I will walk through this, I will say yes to this. The enlightened heart doesn't have to run away from anything. And you know, one of the ways we often run away from things is we get defensive, like even with our most intimate partners. And, oh, do I think of heaven as the place where I never have to get defensive again, where I can just look at what the situation is without bristling. And I know there's at least one person in the room that would be, well, why don't you start putting that into practice? King Herod, this is one of the great lines of all of Scripture. Go search diligently for the child, and when you find him, bring me word so that I may also worship him. You know, this, we don't hear the rest of the story here today, but this is, of course, you know, Herod learns that he's been tricked. He's furious. Almost everyone says this did not happen, but it's a theological sort of statement about power and about the world into which Jesus was born. And so Herod finds that the wise men have tricked him, and he goes and does a kind of a dragnet and says, kill all the children under 2 years old. Kill all the young children. Which is, of course, where we get our hymn, the Coventry Carol. You know, Herod, in his might, in his raging, has sent all the soldiers to kill. I think we are really asked as mature people of faith to recognize the difference between the kingship of Herod and the kingship of Christ. And we can talk about those differences, but I think central, Herod represents a kind of power that is oriented toward me. And it sees the world in terms of yours and mine. And the power, the more power you have, the more you can get. And the alternative to that is what Jesus brings, where there is no power at all that is lorded over anyone. The power that is available, the real power, the significant power, the power that it is our spiritual quest to recognize, is a power that is shared by everyone. Doesn't belong to anyone. Nobody gets to control it. Not even religions. Nobody gets to control this power. And the power represented by Herod despises the power brought by Christ. They are mortal enemies. You cannot serve two masters. You can't be devoted to your own selfishness and be devoted to the common good. And so the word for us is, again, Jesus, I send you out as sheep among wolves. You must be wise as serpents, innocent as doves. The wise as serpent part, we really need to understand that Herod runs the world. Herod is in control of most of the world's institutions, most of the world's governments, most of the world's religions. And yet the task is, that's the wise as serpent's part. The innocent as doves is, how do you keep your heart open in that recognition and not become cynical and always understand that nobody is fixed in the position where you might find them, but that transformation and change is always possible no matter where anyone is. No one ever gets beyond the reach of God. You can't put yourself out of the playing field. How do you stay open, understanding that Herod's power rules most of the world? We have to be wise about that. We have to understand that and we cannot be cynical. And so the story is of this just inexpressibly precious presence coming into the world that is balm for every one of us, healing and restoring and thrilling us. When the star stopped, they were overjoyed. I mean, what we're talking about here is not just some kind of religious virtue. We're talking about what is the deepest pleasure and delight that we can ever experience in this human life. That sense of oneness and of belonging and of complete openness and surrender. Merry Christmas. Merry Christmas, because that's the gift that is brought among us. That this tender little light that will show us a way to make sense of all and will allow us to recognize even the dark characters, even Herod twirling his beard, saying, "Bring me the little child, because I want to worship him in my way." We'll see all of that, and yet the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness doesn't overwhelm it, either in our hearts or in the world. And we have the great privilege of recognizing that light and serving it and saying, "Oh, may it come forth, and may it